through all the ages, man has believed in an invisible power, through which and by which all things have been created and are continually being recreated. We may personalize this power and call it God, or we may think of it as the essence or spirit which permeates all things, but in either case the effect is still the same. So far as the individual is concerned, the objective, the physical, the visible, is the personal, that which can be cognized by the senses. It consists of body, brain, and nerves. The subjective is the spiritual, the invisible, the impersonal. The personal is conscious because it is a personal entity. The impersonal being, the same in kind and quality as all other beings, is not conscious of itself and has therefore been termed the subconscious. The personal or conscious has the power of will and choice, and can therefore exercise discrimination in the selection of methods whereby to bring about the solution of difficulties. The impersonal, or spiritual, being a part or one with the source and origin of all power, can necessarily exercise no such choice, but on the contrary, it has infinite resources at its command. It can and does bring about results by methods concerning which the human or individual mind can have no possible conception. You will therefore see that this is your privilege to depend upon the human will with all of its limitations and misconceptions, or you may utilize the potentialities of infinity by making use of the subconscious mind. Here then is the scientific explanation of the wonderful power which has been put within your control, if you but understand, appreciate, and recognize it. One method of consciously utilizing this omnipresent power is outlined now in Part 7. Visualization is the process of making mental images, and the image is the mold or the model which will serve as a pattern from which your future will emerge. Make the pattern clear and make it beautiful. Don't be afraid. Make it grand. Remember that no limitation can be placed upon you by anyone but yourself. You are not limited as to cost or material. Draw on the infinite for your supply. Construct it in your imagination. It will have to be there before it will ever appear anywhere else. Make the image clear and clean cut. Hold it firmly in the mind, and you will gradually and constantly bring the thing nearer to you. You can be what you will to be. This is another psychological fact which is well known, but unfortunately, reading about it will not bring about any result which you may have in mind. It won't even help you to form the mental image, much less bring it into manifestation. Work is necessary. Labor. Hard mental labor. The kind of effort which so few are willing to put forth. The first step is idealization. It is likewise the most important step because it is the plan on which you are going to build. It must be solid. It must be permanent. The architect, when he plans a 30-story building, has every line and detail pictured in advance. The engineer, when he spans a chasm, first ascertains the strength requirements of a million separate parts. They see the end before a single step is taken. So you are to picture in your mind what you want. You are sowing the seed, but before sowing any seed, you want to know what the harvest is to be. This is idealization. If you are not sure, return to the chair daily until the picture becomes plain. It will gradually unfold. First, the general plan will be dim, but it will take shape. The outline will take form, then the details, and you will gradually develop the power by which you will be enabled to formulate plans which will eventually materialize in the objective world. You will come to know what the future holds for you. Then comes the process of visualization. You must see the picture more and more complete, see the detail, and as the details begin to unfold, the ways and means for bringing it into manifestation will develop. One thing will lead to another. Thought will lead to action. Action will develop methods. Methods will develop friends, and friends will bring about circumstances, and finally the third step, or materialization, will have been accomplished. We all recognize the universe must have been thought into shape before it could ever have become a material fact, and if we're willing to follow along the lines of the great architect of the universe, we shall find our thoughts taking form just as the universe took concrete form. It's the same mind operating through the individual. There is no difference in kind or quality. The only difference is one of degree. The architect visualizes his buildings. He sees it as he wishes it to be. His thought becomes a plastic mold from which the building will eventually emerge, a high one or a low one, a beautiful one or a plain one. His vision takes form on paper, and eventually the necessary material is utilized and the building stands complete. The inventor visualizes his idea in exactly the same manner. For instance, Nikola Tesla, he with the giant intellect, one of the greatest inventors of all ages, The man who has brought forth the most amazing realities always visualizes his inventions before attempting to work them out. He did not rush to embody them in form and then spend his time in correcting defects. Having first built up the idea in his imagination, he held it there as a mental picture to be reconstructed and improved by his thought. In this way, he writes in The Electrical Experimenter, I am enabled to rapidly develop and perfect a conception without touching anything. When I have gone so far as to embody in the invention every possible improvement I can think of and see no fault anywhere, I put it into concrete, the product of my brain. Invariably, my device works, and as I conceived it should. In 20 years, there's not been a single exception. Now, if you can consciously follow these directions, you'll develop faith, the kind of faith that is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. You will develop confidence, the kind of confidence that leads you to endurance and courage. You'll develop the power of concentration, which will enable you to exclude all thoughts except for the ones which are associated with your purpose. The law is that thought will manifest in form, and only one who knows how to be the divine thinker of his own thoughts can ever take a master's place and speak with authority. Clearness and accuracy are obtained only by repeatedly having the image in mind. Each repeated action renders the image more clear and accurate than the preceding, and in proportion to the clearness and accuracy of the image, it will outline toward manifestation. You must build it firmly and securely in your mental world, the world within, before it can take form in the world without, and you can build nothing of value, even in the mental world, unless you have the proper material. When you have the material, you can build anything you wish, but make sure of your material. You cannot make broadcloth from shoddy. This material will be brought out by millions of silent mental workers and fashioned into the form of the image which you have in mind. Now think of it. You have over 5 million of these mental workers ready and in active use. They're called brain cells. Besides this, there's another reserve force of at least an equal number ready to be called into action at the slightest need. Your power to think, then, is almost unlimited, and this means that your power to create the kind of material which is necessary to build for yourself any kind of environment which you desire is practically unlimited. In addition to these millions of mental workers, you have billions of mental workers in the body, every one of which is endowed with sufficient intelligence to understand and act upon any message or suggestion given. These cells are all busy creating and recreating the body, but in addition to this, they are endowed with psychic activity whereby they can attract to themselves the substance necessary for perfect development. They do this by the same law and in the same manner that every form of life attracts to itself the necessary material for growth. The oak, the rose, the lily, they all require certain material for their most perfect expression, and they secure it by silent demand, the law of attraction, the most certain way for you to secure what you require for your most complete development. Make the mental image, make it clear, distinct, perfect. Hold it firmly. The ways and means will develop. Supply will follow. The demand, you will be led to do the right thing at the right time and in the right way. Earnest desire will bring about confident expectation, and this in turn must be reinforced by firm demand. These three cannot fail to bring about attainment because the earnest desire is the feeling, the confident expectation is the thought, and the firm demand is the will. And as we've seen, feeling gives vitality to thought, and the will holds it steadily until the law of growth brings it into manifestation. Is it not wonderful that man has such tremendous power within himself, such transcendental faculties concerning which he had no conception? Is it not strange that we have always been taught to look for strength and power without? We've been taught to look everywhere but within, and whenever this power manifested in our lives, we were told that it was something supernatural. There are many who have come to an understanding of this wonderful power, and who make more serious and conscientious efforts to realize health, power, and other conditions, and they seem to fail. They don't seem to be able to bring the law into operation. The difficulty in nearly every case is that they're dealing with externals. They want money, power, health, and abundance, but they fail to realize that these are the effects and can come only when the cause is found. Those who will give no attention to the world without will seek only to ascertain the truth. They will look only for wisdom, and they will find that this wisdom will unfold and disclose the source of all power, that it will manifest in thought and purpose, which will create the external conditions desired. This truth will find expression in noble purpose and courageous action. Create ideals only. Give no thought to the external conditions. Make the world within beautiful and opulent, and the world without will express and manifest the condition which you have within. You will come into a realization of your power to create ideals, and these ideals will be projected into the world of effect. For instance, a man is in debt. He will continually be thinking about the debt, concentrating on it, and his thoughts are causes. The result is that he not only fastens the debt closer to him, but he actually creates more debt. He's putting the great law of attraction into operation with the usual and inevitable result. Loss leads to greater loss. So what then is the correct principle? Concentrate on the things you want, not on the things you don't want. Think of abundance. Idealize the methods and plans for putting the law of abundance into operation. Visualize the condition which the law of abundance creates. This will result in manifestation. If the law operates perfectly to bring about poverty, lack, and every form of limitation for those who are continually entertaining thoughts of lack and fear, it will operate with the same certainty to bring about conditions of abundance and opulence for those who entertain thoughts of courage and of power. This is a difficult problem for many. We are too anxious. We manifest anxiety, fear, and distress. We want to do something. We want to help. We are like a child who has just planted a seed and every 15 minutes goes and stirs up the earth to see if it's growing. Of course, under such circumstances, the seed will never germinate. Yet this is exactly what many of us do in the mental world. So we must plant the seed and leave it undisturbed. This doesn't mean that we are to sit down and do nothing. By no means. We will do more and better work than we have ever done before. New channels will constantly be provided. New doors will open. All that is necessary is to have an open mind, so be ready to act when the time comes. Thought force is the most powerful means of obtaining knowledge, and if concentrated on any subject will solve the problem. Nothing is beyond the power of human comprehension, but in order to harness thought force and make it do your bidding, work is required. Remember that thought is the fire that creates the steam that turns the wheel of fortune upon which your experiences depend. Now ask yourself a few questions and then reverently await the response. Do you not now and then feel the self with you? Do you assert this self or do you follow the majority? Remember that majorities are always led, they never lead. It was the majority that fought tooth and nail against the steam engine, the power loom, and every other advance or improvement ever suggested. For your exercise this week, visualize your friend. See him exactly as you last saw him. See the room, the furniture. Recall the conversation. Now see his face. See it distinctly. Now talk to him about some subject of mutual interest. See his expression change. Watch him smile. Can you do this? All right, you can. Then arouse his interest. Tell him a story of adventure. See his eyes light up with a spirit of fun or excitement. Can you do all of this? Well, if so, your imagination is good. You are making excellent progress. You will find that you may freely choose what you think, but the result of your thought is governed by an immutable law. Is not this a wonderful thought? Is it not wonderful to know that our lives are not subject to capriciousness or variability of any kind? They are governed by law. This stability is our opportunity because by complying with the law, we can secure the desired effect with invariable precision. It is the law which makes the universe one grand pawn of harmony. If it were not for law, the universe would be a chaos instead of a cosmos. Here then is the secret of the origin of both good and evil. This is all the good and evil that there ever was or ever will be. Let me illustrate. Thought results in action. If your thought is constructive and harmonious, the result will be good. If your thought is destructive or inharmonious, the result will be evil. There is therefore but one law, one principle, one cause, and one source of power, and good and evil are simply words which have been coined to indicate the result of our action, or our compliance or noncompliance with the law. The importance of this is well illustrated in the lives of Emerson and Carlyle. Emerson loved the good life, and his life was a symphony of peace and harmony. Carlyle hated the bad, and his life was a record of perpetual discord and inharmony. Here we have two grand men, each intent upon achieving the same ideal, but one makes use of constructive thought and is therefore in harmony with natural law. The other makes use of destructive thought and is therefore bringing upon himself discord of every kind and character. It is evident, therefore, that we are to hate nothing, not even the bad, because hatred is destructive, and we shall soon find that by entertaining destructive thought we are sowing the wind and in turn shall reap the whirlwind. Here's part 8. Thought contains a vital principle because it is the creative principle of the universe, and by its nature will combine with other similar thoughts. As the one purpose of life is growth, all principles underlying existence must contribute to give it effect. Thought, therefore, takes form, and the laws of growth eventually brings it into manifestation. You may freely choose what you think, but the result of your thought is governed by an immutable law. Any line of thought persisted in cannot fail to produce its result in the character, health, and circumstances of the individual. Methods whereby we can substitute habits of constructive thinking for those which we have found produce only undesirable effects and are therefore of primary importance. We all know that this is by no means easy. Mental habits are difficult to control, but it can be done. And the way to do it is to begin at once to substitute constructive thought for destructive thought. Form the habit of analyzing every thought. If it's necessary, if its manifestation in the objective will be a benefit, not only to yourself, but to all whom it may affect in any way, keep it. Treasure it. It is of value. It is in tune with the infinite. It will grow and develop and produce fruit an hundredfold. On the other hand, it will be well for you to keep this quotation from George Matthew Adams in mind. And I quote, "Learn to keep the door shut. Keep out of your mind, out of your office, and out of your world every element that seeks admittance with no definite helpful end in view." End quote. If your thought has been critical or destructive and has resulted in any condition of discord or inharmony in your environment, it may be necessary for you to cultivate a mental attitude which will be conducive to constructive thought. The imagination will be found to be a great assistance in this direction. The cultivation of the imagination leads to the development of the ideal out of which your future will emerge. The imagination gathers up the material by which the mind weaves the fabric in which your future is to be clothed. Imagine is the light by which we can penetrate new worlds of thought and experience. Imagination is the mighty instrument by which every discoverer, every inventor, opened the way from precedent to experience. Precedent says it can't be done. Experience says it is done. Imagination is a plastic power, molding the things of sense into new forms and ideals. Imagination is the constructive form of thought which must precede every constructive form of action. A builder cannot build a structure of any kind until he has first received the plans from the architect, and the architect has to get them from his imagination. The captain of industry cannot build a giant corporation which may coordinate hundreds of smaller corporations and thousands of employees and utilize millions of dollars of capital until he has first created the entire work in his imagination. Objects in the material world are as clay in the potter's hand. It is in the mastermind that the real things are created, and it is by the use of the imagination that the work is done. In order to cultivate the imagination, it must be exercised. Exercise is necessary to cultivate muscle as well as physical muscle. It must be supplied with nourishment or it cannot grow. Now, don't confuse imagination with fancy or that form of daydreaming in which some people like to indulge. Daydreaming is a form of mental dissipation which may lead to mental disaster. Constructive imagination means mental labor by some considered to be the hardest kind of labor. But if so, it yields the greatest returns, for all of the things in life have come to men and women who had the capacity to think, to imagine, and to make their dreams come true. When you've become thoroughly conscious of the fact that mind is the only creative principle, that it is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, and that you can consciously come into harmony with this omnipotence through your power of thought, then you will have taken a long step in the right direction. The next step is to place yourself in position to receive this power. As it is omnipresent, it must be within you. We know that this is so because we know that all power is from within, but it must be developed, unfolded, cultivated, and in order to do this, we must be receptive. And this receptivity is acquired just as physical strength is gained by exercise. The law of attraction will certainly and unerringly bring to you the conditions, environment, and experiences in life corresponding with your habitual characteristic, predominant mental attitude. Not what you think once in a while when you're in church or have just read a good book, but your predominant mental attitude is what counts. You can't entertain weak, harmful, negative thoughts 10 hours a day and expect to bring about beautiful, strong, and harmonious conditions by 10 minutes of strong, positive, creative thought. Real power comes from within. All power that anybody can possibly use is within man, only waiting to be brought into visibility by his first recognizing it and then affirming it as his, working it into his consciousness until he becomes one with it. Now, people say they desire abundant life, and so they do. But so many interpret this to mean that if they will exercise their muscles or breathe scientifically, eat certain foods in certain ways, drink so many glasses of water every day of just a certain temperature, keep out of drafts, they will attain the abundant life they seek. Now, the result of such methods is but indifferent. However, when a man awakens to the truth and affirms his oneness with all life, he finds that he takes on the clear eye, the elastic step, the vigor of youth. He finds that he has discovered the source of all power. All mistakes are but the mistakes of ignorance. Knowledge gaining and consequent power is what determines growth and evolution. The recognition and demonstration of knowledge is what constitutes power. And this power is spiritual power, and this spiritual power is the power which lies at the heart of all things. It is the soul of the universe. This knowledge is the result of man's ability to think. Thought is therefore the germ of man's conscious evolution. When man ceases to advance in his thoughts and ideals, his forces immediately begin to disintegrate, and his countenance gradually registers these changing conditions. Successful men make it their business to hold ideals of the conditions which they wish to realize. They constantly hold in mind the next step necessary to the ideal for which they are striving. Thoughts are the materials with which they build, and the imagination is their mental workshop. Mind is the ever-moving force with which they secure the persons and circumstances necessary to build their success structure, and imagination is the matrix in which all great things are fashioned. If you've been faithful to your ideal, you will hear the call when circumstances are ready to materialize your plans, and results will correspond in the exact ratio of the fidelity to your ideal. The ideal steadily held is what predetermines and attracts the necessary conditions for its fulfillment. It is thus that you may weave a garment of spirit and power into the web of your entire existence. It is thus that you may lead a charmed life and be forever protected from all harm. It is thus that you may become a positive force, whereby conditions of opulence and harmony may be attracted to you. This is the leaven which is gradually permeating the general consciousness and is largely responsible for the conditions of unrest which are everywhere evident. In the last part, you created a mental image. You brought it from the invisible into the visible. This week I want you to take an object and follow it back to its origination. See of what it really consists. If you do this, you will develop imagination, insight, perception, and sagacity. These come not by the superficial observation of the multitude, but by a keen, analytical observation which sees below the surface. It is the few who know that the things which they see are only effects and understand the causes by which these effects were brought into existence. Take the same position as heretofore and visualize a battleship. See the grim monster floating on the surface of the water. There appears to be no life anywhere about. All is silence. You know that by far the largest part of the vessel is underwater out of sight. You know that the ship is as large and as heavy as a 20-story skyscraper. You know that there are hundreds of men ready to spring to their appointed task instantly. You know that every department is in charge of able, trained, skilled officials who have proven themselves competent to take charge of this marvelous piece of mechanism. You know that although it lies apparently oblivious to everything else, it has eyes which see everything for miles around, and nothing is permitted to escape its watchful vision. You know that while it appears quiet, submissive, and innocent, it is prepared to hurl a steel projectile weighing thousands of pounds at an enemy many miles away. This and much more you can bring to mind with comparatively no effort whatsoever. But how did the battleship come to be where it is? How did it come into existence in the first place? All of this you want to know if you're a careful observer. Now follow the great steel plates through the foundries. See the thousands of men employed in their production. Go still further back and see the ore as it comes from the mine. See it loaded on barges or cars. See it melted and properly treated. Go back still further and see the architect and engineers who planned the vessel. Let the thought carry you back still further in order to determine why they planned the vessel. You'll see that you're now so far back that the vessel is something intangible. It no longer exists. It is now only a thought that exists in the brain of the architect. But from where did the order plan come? Probably from the Secretary of Defense. But probably this vessel was planned long before the war was thought of, and the Congress had to pass a bill appropriating the money. Possibly there was opposition and speeches for or against the bill. Now, whom do these congressmen represent? Well, they represent you and me, so that our line of thought begins with the battleship and ends with ourselves, and we find in the last analysis that our own thought is responsible for this and many other things of which we seldom think. And a little further reflection will develop the most important fact of all, and that is, if someone had not discovered the law by which this tremendous mass of steel and iron could be made to float upon the water, instead of immediately going to the bottom of the sea, the battleship could not have come into existence at all. This law is that the specific gravity of any substance is the weight of any volume of it, compared with an equal volume of water. The discovery of this law revolutionized every kind of ocean travel, commerce, and warfare, and it made the existence of the battleship, aircraft carriers, and cruise ships possible. You'll find exercises of this kind invaluable. When the thought has been trained to look below the surface, everything takes on a different appearance. The insignificant becomes significant. The uninteresting, interesting. The things which we suppose to be of no importance are seen to be the only really vital things in existence. Here's a message called Look to This Day. For it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of your existence. The bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today well lived makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Now, that's from the Sanskrit. In this part, you may learn to fashion the tools by which you may build for yourself any condition you desire. If you wish to change conditions, you must change yourself. Your whims, your wishes, your fancies, your ambitions may be thwarted at every step, but your inmost thoughts will find expression, just as certainly as the plant springs from seed. Suppose, then, we desire to change conditions. How are we to bring about this? The reply is simple, by the law of growth. Cause and effect are as absolute and undeviating in the hidden realm of thought as in the world of material things. Hold in mind the condition desired. Affirm it as an already existing fact. This indicates the value of a powerful affirmation. By constant repetition, it becomes a part of ourselves. We are actually changing ourselves. We're making ourselves what we want to be. Character is not a thing of chance, but it is the result of continued effort. If you are timid, vacillating, self-conscious, or if you are over-anxious or harassed by thoughts of fear or impending danger, remember that it is axiomatic that the two things cannot exist in the same place at the same time. Exactly the same thing is true in the mental and spiritual world, so that your remedy is plainly to substitute thoughts of courage, power, and self-reliance, as well as confidence, for those of fear, lack, and limitation. The easiest and most natural way to do this is to select an affirmation which seems to fit your particular case. The positive thought will destroy the negative as certainly as light destroys darkness, and the results will be just as effectual. Act is the blossom of thought, and conditions are the result of action, so that you constantly have in your possession the tools by which you will certainly and inevitably make or unmake yourself, and joy or suffering will be the reward. Part 9. There are only three things which can possibly be desired in the world without, and each of them can be found in the world within. The secret of finding them is simply to apply the proper mechanism of attachment to the omnipotent power to which each individual has access. The three things which all mankind desires and which are necessary for his highest expression and complete development are health, wealth, and love. All will admit that health is absolutely essential, so no one can be happy if the physical body is in pain. All will not so readily admit that wealth is necessary, but all must admit that a sufficient supply at least is necessary, and what would be considered sufficient for one would be considered absolute and painful lack for another. And as nature provides, not only enough but abundantly, wastefully, lavishly, we realize that any lack or limitation is only the limitation. All will probably admit that love is the third, or maybe some will say the first, essential, necessary to the happiness of mankind. At any rate, those who possess all three, health, wealth, and love, find nothing else which can be added to their cup of happiness. We have found that the universal substance is all health, all substance, and all love, and that the mechanism of attachment whereby we can consciously connect with this infinite supply is in our method of thinking. To think correctly is therefore to enter into the secret place of the Most High. Well, what shall we think? If we know this, we shall have found the proper mechanism of attachment which will relate to us. Whatsoever things we desire, This mechanism may seem very simple when I give it to you, but read on. You will find that it is in reality the master key, the Aladdin's lamp, if you please. You'll find that it's the foundation, the imperative condition, the absolute law of well-doing, which means well-being. To think correctly and accurately, we must know the truth. The truth, then, is the underlying principle in every business or social relation. It's a condition precedent to every right action. To know the truth, to be sure, to be confident, affords a satisfaction beside which no other is at all comparable. It is only the solid ground in a world of doubt, conflict, and danger. To know the truth is to be in harmony with the infinite and omnipotent power. To know the truth is, therefore, to connect yourself with a power which is irresistible and which will sweep away every kind of discord, in harmony, doubt, or error of any kind, because the truth is mighty, and it will prevail. The humblest intellect can readily foretell the result of any action when he knows that it is based on truth. But the mightiest intellect, the most profound and penetrating mind, loses its way hopelessly, and can form no conception of the results which may ensue when his hopes are based on a premise which he knows to be false. Every action which is not in harmony with truth, whether through ignorance or design, will result in discord and eventual loss in proportion to its extent and character. How then are we to know the truth in order to attach this mechanism which will relate us to the infinite? We can make no mistake about this if we realize the truth is the vital principle of the universal mind and is omnipresent. For instance, if you require health, a realization of the fact that the I in you is spiritual and that all spirit is one, that wherever a part is the whole must be, will bring about a condition of health, because every cell in the body must manifest the truth as you see it. If you see sickness, they will manifest sickness. If you see perfection, they must manifest perfection. The affirmation that I am whole, perfect, strong, powerful, loving, harmonious, and happy will bring about harmonious conditions. The reason for this is because the affirmation is in strict accordance with the truth. And when truth appears, every form of error or discord must necessarily disappear. Now, you found that the I is spiritual. It must be necessarily then always be no less than perfect. The affirmation, I am whole, perfect, strong, powerful, loving, harmonious, and happy, is therefore an exact scientific statement. Thought is a spiritual activity and spirit is creative. Therefore, the result of holding this thought in mind must necessarily bring about conditions in harmony with the thought. If you require wealth, a realization of the fact that the I in you is one with the universal mind, which is all substance and is omnipotent, will assist you in bringing into operation the law of attraction, which will bring you into vibration with those forces which make for success and bring about conditions of power and affluence in direct proportion with the character and purpose of your affirmation. Visualization is the mechanism of the attachment which you require. Visualization is a very different process from seeing. Seeing is physical, and it's therefore related to the objective world, the world without. But visualization is a product of the imagination, and is therefore a product of the subjective mind, the world within. It is therefore possessing vitality, and it will grow. The thing visualized will manifest itself in form. The mechanism is perfect. It was created by the master architect who doeth all things well. But unfortunately, sometimes the operator is inexperienced or inefficient, but practice and determination will overcome this deficit. If you require love, try to realize that the only way to get love is by giving it, that the more you give, the more you'll get, and the only way in which you can give it is to fill yourself with it until you become a magnet. The method was explained in another lesson. He who has learned to bring the greatest spiritual truth into touch with the so-called lesser things of life has discovered the secret of the solution of his problem. One is always quickened, made more thoughtful, by his nearness of approach to great ideas, great events, great natural objects, and great men. Lincoln is said to have begotten in all who came near him the feeling awakened when one approaches a mountain, and this sense asserts itself most keenly when one comes to realize that he has laid hold upon things that are eternal, the power of truth. It is sometimes an inspiration to hear from someone who has actually put these principles to the test, someone who has demonstrated them in their own life. A letter from Frederick Andrews offers the following insight. I was about 13 years old when Dr. T.W. Marcy, since passed over, said to my mother, There is no possible chance, Mrs. Andrews, I lost my little boy the same way, after doing everything for him that it was possible to do. I've made a special study of these cases, and I know there is no possible chance for him to get well. She turned to him and said, Doctor, what would you do if he were your boy? And he answered, I would fight. Fight as long as there's a breath of life to fight for. That was the beginning of a long, drawn-out battle with many ups and downs, the doctors all agreeing that there was no chance for a cure, though they encouraged and cheered us the best they could. But at last the victory came, and I've grown from a little crooked, twisted cripple going about on my hands and knees to a strong, straight, well-formed man. Now, I know you want the formula, and I'll give it to you as briefly and quickly as I can. I build up an affirmation for myself, taking the qualities I most needed and affirming for myself over and over. I am whole, perfect, strong, powerful, loving, harmonious, and happy. I kept up this affirmation always the same, never varying until I could wake up in the night and find myself repeating, I am whole, perfect, strong, powerful, loving, harmonious, and happy. It was the last thing on my lips at night and the first thing in the morning. Not only did I affirm it for myself, but I affirmed it for others that I knew needed it. I want to emphasize this point. Whatever you desire for yourself, affirm it for others, and it will help you both. We reap what we sow. If we send out thoughts of love and health, they return to us like bread cast upon the waters. But if we send out thoughts of fear, worry, jealousy, anger, hate, etc., we're going to reap the results in our own lives. It used to be said that man is completely built over every 7 years. But some scientists now declare that we build ourselves over entirely every 11 months, so we are really only 11 months old. If we build the defects back into our body year after year, we have no one to blame but ourselves. So man is the sum total of his own thoughts. So the question is, how are we going to entertain only the good thoughts and reject the evil ones? At first, we can't keep the evil thoughts from coming, but we can keep from entertaining them. The only way to do this is to forget them, which means get something for them. This is where the ready-made affirmation comes into play. When a thought of anger, jealousy, fear, or worry creeps in, just start your affirmation going. The way to fight darkness is with light. The way to fight cold is with heat. The way to overcome evil is with good. For myself, I never could find any help in denials. Affirm the good, and the bad will vanish. Signed, Frederick Elias Andrews. If there's anything you require, it will be well for you to make use of this affirmation. It cannot be improved upon. Use it just as it is. Take it into the silence with you until it sinks into your subconsciousness. That way you can use it anywhere, in your car, in the office, at home. This is the advantage of spiritual methods. They are always available. Spirit is omnipresent, ever ready, and all that is required is a proper recognition of its omnipotence and a willingness or desire to become the recipient of its beneficent efforts. If our predominant mental attitude is one of power, courage, kindliness, and sympathy, we shall find that our environment will reject conditions in correspondence with these thoughts. If it is weak, critical, envious, and destructive, we shall find our environment reflecting conditions corresponding to these thoughts. Thoughts are causes and conditions are effects. Herein is the explanation of the origin of both good and evil. Thought is creative and will automatically correlate with its object. This is a cosmological law, a universal law. The law of attraction, the law of cause and effect, the recognition and application of this law will determine both beginning and end. It is by the law by which in all ages and in all times the people were led to believe in the power of prayer. As thy faith is, so be it unto thee. It's simply another shorter and better way of stating it. So this week, visualize a plant. Take a flower, the one you most admire. Bring it from the unseen into the seen. Plant the tiny seed, water it, care for it. Place it where it will get the direct rays of the morning sun. See the seed burst. It is now a living thing. Something which is alive and beginning to search for the means of substance. See the roots penetrating the earth. Watch them shoot out in all directions. And remember that they are living cells, dividing and subdividing, and that they will soon number millions, that each cell is intelligent, that it knows what it wants and knows how to get it. See the stem shoot forward and upward. Watch it burst through the surface of the earth. See it divide and form branches. See how perfect and symmetrical each branch is formed. See the leaves begin to form, and then the tiny stems, each one holding aloft a bud. And as you watch, you see the bud begin to unfold, and your favorite flower comes to view. And now, if you will concentrate intently, you'll become conscious of a fragrance. It's the fragrance of the flower as the breeze gently sways the beautiful creation which you have just visualized. When you are enabled to make your decision and vision clear and complete, you'll be enabled to enter into the spirit of a thing. It will become very real to you. You will be learning to concentrate, and the process is the same whether you're concentrating on health, a favorite flower, an ideal, a complicated business proposition, or any other problem of life. And remember, every success has been accomplished by persistent concentration upon the object in view.
If you get a thorough understanding, or the thought contained in Part 10, you will have learned that nothing happens without a definite cause. You will be enabled to formulate your plans in accordance with exact knowledge. You will then know how to control any situation by bringing adequate causes into play. When you win, as you will know exactly why. The ordinary man who has no definite knowledge of cause and effect is governed by his feelings or emotions. He thinks chiefly to justify his action. If he fails as a businessman, he says that luck is against him. If he dislikes music, he says that music is an expensive luxury. If he is a poor office man, he says that he could succeed better at some outdoor work. Or if he lacks friends, he says his individuality is too fine to be appreciated. He never thinks his problem through to the end. In short, he does not know that every effect is the result of a certain definite cause, but he seeks to console himself with explanations and excuses. He thinks only in self-defense. On the contrary, the man who understands that there is no effect without an adequate cause thinks impersonally. He gets down to bedrock facts regardless of consequences. He is free to follow the trail of truth wherever it may lead. He sees the issue clear to the end, and he meets the requirements fully and fairly, and the result is that the world gives him all that it has to give in friendship, honor, love, and approval. Part 10. Abundance is a natural law of the universe. The evidence of this law is conclusive. We see it on every hand. Everywhere nature is lavish, wasteful, extravagant. Nowhere is economy observed in any created thing. Profusion is manifested in everything. The millions and millions of trees and flowers and plants and animals and the vast scheme of reproduction, where the process of creating and recreating is forever going on, all indicates the lavishness with which nature has made provision for man. That there is an abundance for everyone is evident, but that many fail to participate in this abundance is also evident. They've not yet come into a realization of the universality of all substance, and that mind is the active principle whereby we are related to the things we desire. All wealth is the offspring of power. Possessions are of value only as they confer power. Events are significant only as they affect power. All things represent certain forms and degrees of power. Knowledge of cause and effect, as shown by the laws governing electricity, chemical affinity, and gravitation, enables man to plan courageously and execute fearlessly. These laws are called natural laws because they govern in the physical world, but all power is not physical power. There is also mental power, and there is moral and spiritual power. Spiritual power is superior because it exists on a higher plane. It has enabled man to discover the law by which these wonderful forces of nature could be harnessed and made to do the work of hundreds and thousands of men. It has enabled man to discover laws whereby time and space have been annihilated and the law of gravitation to be overcome. The operation of this law is dependent upon every spiritual contact. As Henry Drummond well says, "In the physical world as we know it, there exist the organic and the inorganic. The ignorance of the mineral world is absolutely cut off from the plant or animal world. The passage is hermetically sealed. These barriers have never yet been crossed. No change of substance, no modification of environment, no chemistry, no electricity, no form of energy, no evolution of any kind can ever endow a single atom of the mineral world with the attribute of life. Only by the bending down into this dead world of some living form can those dead atoms be gifted with the properties of vitality. Without this contact with life, they remain fixed in the inorganic sphere forever." Huxley goes on to say that the doctrine of biogenesis, or life only from life, is victorious all along the line, and Tyndall is compelled to say, "I affirm that no shred of trustworthy evidence exists to prove that life in our day has ever appeared independent of antecedent life." Physical laws may explain the inorganic. Biology explains and accounts for the development of the organic, but of the point of contact, science is silent. A similar passage exists between the natural world and the spiritual world. This passage is hermetically sealed on the natural side. The door is closed. No man can open it. No organic change, no mental energy, no moral effort, no progress of any kind can enable any human being to enter the spiritual world. But as the plant reaches down into the mineral world and touches it with the mystery of life, so the universal mind reaches down into the human mind and endows it with new, strange, wonderful, and even marvelous qualities. All men or women who have ever accomplished anything in the world of industry, commerce, or art have accomplished because of this particular process. Thought is the connecting link between the infinite and the finite, between the universal and the individual. We have seen that there is an impassable barrier between the organic and the inorganic, and that the only way that matter can unfold is to be impregnated with life. As a seed reaches down into the mineral world and begins to unfold and reach out, the dead matter begins to live. 1,000 invisible fingers begin to weave a suitable environment for the new arrival. And as the law of growth begins to take effect, we see the process continue until the lily finally appears. And even Solomon, in all of his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. Even so, a thought is dropped into the invisible substance of the universal mind, that substance from which all things are created. And as it takes root, the law of growth begins to take effect, and we find that conditions and environment. The law is that thought is an active, vital form of dynamic energy, which has the power to correlate with its object and bring it out of the invisible substance from which all things are created into the visible or objective world. This is the law by which and through which all things come into manifestation. It is the master key by which you are admitted into the secret place of the Most High and are given dominion over all things. With an understanding of this law, you may decree a thing, and it shall be established unto thee. It could not be otherwise if the soul of the universe, as we know it, is the universal spirit. Then the universe is simply the condition which the universal spirit has made for itself. We are simply individualized spirit and are creating the conditions for our growth in exactly the same way. This creative power depends upon our recognition of the potential power of spirit or mind and must not be confused with evolution. Creation is the calling into existence of that which does not exist in the objective world. Evolution is simply the unfolding of potentialities involved in things which already exist. In taking advantage of the wonderful possibilities opened up to us through the operation of this law, we must remember that we ourselves contribute nothing to its efficacy. As the great teacher said, "It is not I that doeth the works, but the Father that dwelleth in me, he doeth the work." We must take exactly the same position that we can do nothing to assist in the manifestation. We simply comply with the law, and the all-originating mind will bring about the results. The great error of the present day is the idea that man has to originate the intelligence whereby the infinite can proceed to bring about a specific purpose or result. Nothing of this kind is necessary. The universal mind can be depended upon to find the ways and the means for bringing about any necessary manifestation. We must, however, create the ideal, and this ideal should be perfect. We know that the laws governing electricity have been formulated in such a way that this invisible power can be controlled and used for our benefit and comfort in thousands of ways. We know that messages are carried around the world, that ponderous machinery does its bidding, that it now illuminates practically the whole world. But we know, too, that if we consciously or ignorantly violate its law by touching a live wire when it is not properly insulated, the result is going to be unpleasant and possibly disastrous. A lack of understanding of the laws governing in the invisible world has the same result, and many are suffering the consequences all of the time. It's been explained that the law of causation depends upon polarity. A circuit must be formed. Now, this circuit cannot be formed unless we operate in harmony with the law. How shall we operate in harmony with the law unless we know what the law is? How shall we know what the law is? It's simple, by study and by observation. We see the law in operation everywhere. All nature testifies to the operation of the law by silently, constantly expressing itself in the law of growth. Where there is growth, there must be life. Where there is life, there must be harmony, so that everything that has life is constantly attracting to itself the conditions and the supply which is necessary for its most complete expression. If your thought is in harmony with the creative principle of nature, It is in tune with the infinite mind, and it will form the circuit. It will not return you to void, but it is possible for you to think thoughts that are not in tune with the infinite, and when there is no polarity, the circuit is not formed. What then is the result? What is the result when a dynamo is generating electricity? The circuit is cut off and there is no outlet. The dynamo stops. It's exactly the same with you. If you entertain thoughts which are not in accordance with the infinite and cannot therefore be polarized, there is no circuit. You are isolated. The thoughts cling to you, harass you, worry you, and finally bring about disease and possibly death. The physician may not diagnose the case exactly in this way. He may give it some fancy name, which has been manufactured for the various ills which are the result of wrong thinking. But nevertheless, the cause is just the same. Constructive thought must necessarily be creative, but creative thought must be harmonious, and this eliminates all destructive or competitive thought. Wisdom, strength, courage, and all harmonious conditions are the result of power, and we have seen that all power is from within. Likewise, every lack, limitation, or adverse circumstance is the result of weakness. And weakness is simply absence of power. It comes from nowhere. It is nothing. The remedy, then, is simply to develop power, and this is accomplished in exactly the same manner that all power is developed, by exercise. This exercise consists in making an application of your knowledge. Knowledge will not apply itself. You must make the application. Abundance will not come to you out of the sky, neither will it drop into your lap, but a conscious realization of the law of attraction and the intention to bring it into operation for a certain definite and specific purpose, and the will to carry out this purpose will bring about the materialization of your desires by a natural law of transference. If you're in business, it will increase and develop along regular channels. Possibly new or unusual channels of distribution are going to be opened, and when the law becomes fully operative, you will find that the things you seek are seeking you. This week, select a blank space on the wall or any other convenient spot from where you usually sit. Mentally draw a black horizontal line about 6 inches long and try to see the line as plainly as though it were painted on the wall. Now mentally draw two vertical lines connecting with this horizontal line at either end. Now draw another horizontal line connecting with the two vertical lines. Now you have a square. Try to see the square perfectly. When you can do so, draw a circle within the square. Now place a point in the center of the circle. Now draw the point toward you about 10 inches. Now you have a cone on a square base. You will remember that your work was all in black. Change it to white, to red, to yellow. If you can do this, you're making excellent progress, and you'll soon be enabled to concentrate on any problem you may have in mind. When any object or purpose is clearly held in thought, its precipitation, intangible and visible form, is merely a question of time. Remember this, the vision always precedes and itself determines the realization. Your life is governed by law, by actual immutable principles that never vary. Law is in operation at all times in all places. Fixed laws underlie all human actions. For this reason, men who control giant industries are enabled to determine with absolute precision just what percentage of every 100,000 people will respond to any given set of conditions. It is well, however, to remember that while every effect is the result of a cause, the effect in turn becomes a cause which creates other effects, which in turn create still other causes, so that when you put the law of attraction into operation, you must remember that you are starting a train of causation for good, or otherwise, which may have endless possibilities. We frequently hear it said, "A very distressing situation came into my life which could not have been the result of my thought, as I certainly never entertained any thought which could have such a result." We fail to remember that like attracts like in the mental world, and that the thought which we entertain brings to us certain friendships, companionships of a particular kind, and these in turn bring about conditions and environment which in turn are responsible for the conditions of which we complain. Here is part 11. Inductive reasoning is the process of the objective mind by which we compare a number of separate instances with one another until we see the common factor that gives rise to them all. Induction proceeds by a comparison of facts. It is this method of studying nature which has resulted in the discovery of a reign of law which has marked an epoch in human progress. It is the dividing line between superstition and intelligence. It has eliminated the elements of uncertainty and caprice from men's lives and substituted law, reason, and certitude. It is the watchman at the gate that we mentioned in a former lesson. When by virtue of this principle the world to which the senses were accustomed had been revolutionized, when the sun had been arrested in his course, the apparently flat earth had been shaped into a ball and set whirling around him, when the inert matter had been resolved into active elements, and the universe presented itself wherever we directed the telescope and microscope, full of force, motion, and life, we are constrained to ask by what possible means the delicate forms of organization in the midst of it are kept in order and repair. Like poles and like forces repel themselves or remain impenetrable to each other, and this cause seems in general sufficient to assign a proper place and distance to stars, men, and forces. As men of different virtues enter into partnership, so do opposite poles attract each other. Elements that have no property in common, like acids and gases, cling to each other in preference, and a general exchange is kept up between the surplus and the demand. As the eye seeks and receives satisfaction from colors complementary to those which are given, so does need, want, and desire, in the largest sense, induce, guide, and determine action. It is our privilege to become conscious of the principle and act in accordance with it. Cuvier sees a tooth belonging to extinct race of animals. This tooth wants a body for the performance of its function, and it defines the peculiar body it stands in need of with such precision that Cuvier is able to reconstruct the frame of this animal. Perturbations are also observed in the motion of Uranus. Le Verrier needs another star at a certain place to keep the solar system in order, and Neptune appears in the place and hour appointed. The instinctive wants of the animal and the intellectual wants of Cuvier, the wants of nature and of the mind of Le Verrier, were alike, and thus the results hear the thoughts of an existence. There is an existence. A well-defined lawful want, therefore, furnishes the reason for the more complex operations of nature. Having recorded correctly the answers furnished by nature and stretched our senses with the growing science over her surface, having joined hands with the levers that move the earth, we become conscious of such a close, varied, and deep contact with the world without that our wants and purposes become no less identified with the harmonious operations of this vast organization than the life, liberty, and happiness of the citizen is identified with the existence of his government. As the interests of the individual are protected by the arms of the country, added to his own, and his needs may depend upon certain supply in the degree that they are felt more universally and steadily, in the same manner does conscious citizenship in the Republic of Nature secure us from the annoyances of subordinate agents by alliance with superior powers and by appeal to the fundamental laws of resistance or inducement offered to mechanical or chemical agents, distribute the labor to be performed between them and man to the best advantage of the inventor. If Plato could have witnessed the pictures executed by the sun with the assistance of the photographer, or 100 similar illustrations of what man does by induction, he would perhaps have been reminded of the intellectual midwifery of his master, and in his own mind might have arisen the vision of a land where all manual, mechanical labor and repetition is assigned to the power of nature, where our wants are satisfied by purely mental operations set in motion by the will, and where the supply is created by the demand. However distant that land may appear, induction has taught men to make strides toward it, and has surrounded him with benefits which are, at the same time, rewards for past fidelity and incentives for more assiduous devotion. It is also an aid in concentrating and strengthening our faculties for the remaining part, giving unerring solution for individual as well as universal problems by the mere operations of mind in the very purest form. Now here we find a method, the spirit of which is to believe that what is sought has been accomplished in order to accomplish it, a method bequeathed upon us by the same Plato who, outside of this sphere, could never find how the ideas became realities. This conception is also elaborated by Swedenborg in his Doctrine of Correspondences, and still a greater teacher has said, "What things soever ye desire when ye pray, believe that ye will receive them, and ye shall have them." That's from Mark 11, verse 24. The difference of the tenses in this passage is remarkable. We are first to believe that our desire has already been fulfilled. Its accomplishment will then follow. This is a concise direction for making use of the creative power of thought by impressing on the universal subjective mind the particular thing which we desire as an already existing fact. We are thus thinking on the plane of the absolute and eliminating all consideration of conditions or limitations, and are planting a seed which, if left undisturbed, will finally germinate into external fruition. To review, inductive reasoning is the process of the objective mind by which we compare a number of separate instances with one another until we see the common factor that gives rise to them all. We see people in every civilized country on the globe securing results by some process which they do not seem to understand themselves and to which they usually attach more or less mystery. Our reason is given to us for the purpose of ascertaining the law by which these results are accomplished. The operation of this thought process is seen in those fortunate natures that possess everything that others must acquire by toil, who never have a struggle with conscience because they always act correctly and can never conduct themselves otherwise than with tact, learn everything easily, complete everything they begin with a happy knack, live in eternal harmony with themselves without ever reflecting much what they do or ever experiencing difficulty or toil. The fruit of this thought is, as it were, a gift of the gods, but a gift which few as yet realize, appreciate, or understand. The recognition of the marvelous power which is possessed by the mind under proper conditions, and the fact that this power can be utilized, directed, and made available for the solution of every human problem, is of transcendental importance. All truth is the same, whether stated in modern scientific terms or in the language of apostolic times. There are timid souls who fail to realize that the very completeness of truth requires various statement, that no one human formula will show every side of it. Changing emphasis, new language, novel interpretations, unfamiliar perspectives are not, as some people suppose, signs of departure from truth, but on the contrary, they are evidence that the truth is being apprehended in new relations to human needs and is becoming more generally understood. The truth be told to each generation and to every people in new and different terms, so that when the great teacher said, "Believe that ye receive and ye shall receive," or when Paul said, "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen," or when modern science tells us that the law of attraction is the law by which thought correlates with its object, each statement, when subjected to analysis, is found to contain exactly the same truth, the only difference being in the form of presentation. We're standing on the threshold of a new era. The time has arrived when man has learned the secrets of mastery, and the way is being prepared for a new social order more wonderful than anything ever heretofore dreamed of. The conflict of modern science with theology, the study of comparative religions, the tremendous power of new social movements, all of these are but clearing the way for the new order. They may have destroyed traditional forms which have become antiquated and important, but nothing of value has been lost. A new faith has been born, a faith which demands a new form of expression, and this faith is taking form in a deep consciousness of power which is being manifested in the present spiritual activity found on every hand. The spirit which sleeps in the mineral breathes in the vegetable, moves in the animal, and reaches its highest development in man, that's the universal mind, and it behooves us to span the gulf between being and doing, theory and practice, by demonstrating our understanding of the dominion which we've been given. By far the greatest discovery of all the centuries is the power of thought. The importance of this discovery has been a little slow in reaching the general consciousness, but now it has arrived and it's already in every field of research. The importance of this greatest of all great discoveries is being demonstrated. You ask, in what does the creative power of thought consist? It consists in creating ideas, and these in turn objectify themselves by appropriating, inventing, observing, discerning, discovering, analyzing, ruling, governing, combining, and applying matter and force. It can do this because it is an intelligent, creative power. Thought reaches its loftiest activity when plunged into its own mysterious depth, when it breaks through the narrow compass of self and passes from truth to truth to the region of eternal light, where all which is, was, or ever will be, melt into one grand harmony. From this process of self-contemplation comes inspiration, which is creative intelligence, and which is undeniably superior to every element, force, or law of nature, because it can understand, modify, govern, and apply them to its own ends and purposes, and therefore possess them. Wisdom begins with the dawn of reason, and reason is but an understanding of the knowledge and principles whereby we may know the true meaning of things. Wisdom, then, is illuminated reason, and this wisdom leads to humility, for humility is a large part of wisdom. We all know many who have achieved the seemingly impossible, who have realized lifelong dreams, who have changed everything, including themselves. We have sometimes marveled at the demonstration of an apparently irresistible power, which seemed to be ever available just when it was most needed. But it is all clear now. All that is required is an understanding of certain definite fundamental principles and their proper application. For your exercise this week, concentrate on the quotation taken from the Bible. Whatsoever things ye desire, when ye pray, believe that ye receive them, and ye shall have them. Notice there is no limitation. Whatsoever things is very definite and implies that the only limitation which is placed upon us is our ability to think, to be equal to the occasion, to rise to the emergency, to remember that faith is not a shadow, but a substance, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Death is but the natural process whereby all material forms are thrown into the crucible for reproduction and fresh diversity.
Part 12 is enclosed herewith. In the fourth paragraph, you'll find the following statement. You must first have the knowledge of your power, second, the courage to dare, third, the faith to do. If you concentrate upon the thoughts given, if you give them your entire attention, you'll find a world of meaning in each sentence and will attract to yourself other thoughts in harmony with them, and you will soon grasp the full significance of the vital knowledge upon which you are concentrating. Knowledge does not apply itself. We as individuals must make the application, and the application consists in fertilizing the thought with a living purpose. The time and thought which most persons waste in aimless effort would accomplish wonders if properly directed with some special object in view. In order to do this, it is necessary to center your mental force upon a scientific thought and hold it there to the exclusion of all other thoughts. If you've ever looked through the viewfinder of a camera, you found that when the object was not in focus, the impression was indistinct and possibly blurred. But when the proper focus was obtained, the picture was clear and distinct. This illustrates the power of concentration. Unless you can concentrate upon the object which you have in view, you will have but a hazy, indifferent, vague, indistinct, and blurred outline of your ideal, and the results will be in accordance with your mental picture. So now, part 12. There is no purpose in life that cannot be best accomplished through a scientific understanding of the creative power of thought. This power to think is common to all. Man is because he thinks. Man's power to think is infinite. Consequently, his creative power is unlimited. We know that thought is building for us the thing we think of and actually bringing it nearer. Yet we find it difficult to banish fear, anxiety, or discouragement, all of which are powerful thought forces and which continually send the things we desire further away, so that it's often one step forward and two steps back. The only way to keep from going backward is to keep going forward. Eternal vigilance is the price of success. There are three steps, and each one is absolutely essential. You must first have the knowledge of your power, second, the courage to dare, third, the faith to do. With this as a basis, you can construct an ideal business, an ideal home, ideal friends, and an ideal environment. You're not restricted as to material or cost. Thought is omnipotent and has the power to draw on the infinite bank of primary substance for all that it requires. Infinite resources are therefore at your command. But your ideal must be sharp, clear-cut, and definite. To have one ideal today, another tomorrow, and a third next week means to scatter your forces and accomplish nothing. Your result will be a meaningless and chaotic combination of wasted material. Unfortunately, this is the result which many are securing, and the cause itself is evident. If a sculptor started out with a piece of marble and a chisel and changed his ideal every 15 minutes, what result could he expect? And why should you expect any different result in molding the greatest and most plastic of all substances, the only real substance? The result of this indecision and negative thought is often found in the loss of material wealth. Supposed independence, which required many years of toil and effort, suddenly disappears. It is often found then that money and property are not independence at all. On the contrary, the only independence is found to be a practical working knowledge of the creative power of thought. This practical working method cannot come to you until you learn that the only real power which you can have
is the power to adjust yourself to divine and unchangeable principles. You can't change the infinite, but you can come into an understanding of natural laws. The reward of this understanding is a conscious realization of your ability to adjust your thought faculties with the universal thought which is omnipresent. Your ability to cooperate with this omnipotence will indicate the degree of success with which you meet. The power of thought has many counterfeits, which are more or less fascinating, but the results are harmful instead of helpful. Of course, worry, fear, and all negative thoughts produce a crop after their kind. Those who harbor thoughts of this kind must inevitably reap what they have sown. Again, there are the phenomena seekers who gormandize on the so-called proofs and demonstration obtained at materializing seances. They throw open their metal doors and soak themselves in the most poisonous currents which can be found in the psychic world. They don't seem to understand that it is the ability to become negative, receptive, and passive, and thus drain themselves of all their vital force, which enables them to bring about these vibratory thought forms. There are also the Hindu worshippers who see in the materializing phenomena which are performed by the so-called adepts a source of power, forgetting or never seeming to realize that as soon as the will is withdrawn, the forms wither and the vibratory forces of which they are composed vanish. Telepathy or thought transference has received considerable attention, but as it requires a negative mental state on the part of the receiver, the practice can be harmful. A thought may be sent with the intention of hearing or seeing, but it will bring the penalty attached to the inversion of the principle involved. In many instances, hypnotism is positively dangerous to the subject as well as the operator. No one familiar with the laws governing in the mental world would think of attempting to dominate the will of another, for by so doing he will gradually, but surely, divest himself of his own power. All of these perversions have their temporary satisfaction, and for some a keen fascination. But there is an infinitely greater fascination in a true understanding of the world of power within. A power which increases with use is permanent instead of fleeing, which not only is potent as a remedial agency to bring about the remedy for past error or results of wrong thinking, but it's a prophylactic agency protecting us from all manner and form of danger, and finally is an actual creative force with which we can build new conditions and new environments. The law is that thought will correlate with its object and bring forth in the material world the correspondence of the thing thought or produced in the mental world. We then discern the absolute necessity of seeing that every thought has the inherent germ of truth in order that the law of growth will bring into manifestation good, for good alone can confer any permanent power. The principle which gives the thought the dynamic power to correlate with its object and therefore to master every adverse human experience is the law of attraction, which is another name for love. This is an eternal and fundamental principle, inherent in all things, in every system of philosophy, in every religion, and in every science. There is no getting away from the law of love. It is feeling that imparts vitality to thought. Feeling is desire, and desire is love. Thought impregnated with love becomes invincible. We find this truth emphasized wherever the power of thought is understood. The universal mind is not only intelligence, but it is substance, and this substance is the attractive force which brings electrons together by the law of attraction so that they form atoms. The atoms, in turn, are brought together by the same law and form molecules. Molecules take objective forms, and so we find that the law of love is the creative force behind every manifestation, not only of atoms but of worlds, of the universe, of everything which the imagination can form any conception. It's the operation of this marvelous law of attraction which has caused men in all ages and all times to believe that there must be some personal being who responded to their petitions and their desires and manipulated events in order to comply with their requirements. It is the combination of thought and love which forms the irresistible force called the law of attraction. All natural laws are irresistible. The law of gravitation or electricity or any other law operates with mathematical exactitude. There is no variation. It is only the channel of distribution which may be imperfect. If a bridge falls, we do not attribute the collapse to any variation of the law of gravitation. If a light fails us, we do not conclude that the laws governing electricity cannot be depended upon. And if the law of attraction seems to be imperfectly demonstrated by an inexperienced or uninformed person, We're not to conclude that the greatest and most infallible law upon which the entire system of creation depends has been suspended. We should rather conclude that a little more understanding of the law is required. For the same reason that a correct solution of a difficult problem in mathematics is not always readily and easily obtained. Things are created in the mental or spiritual world before they appear in the outward act or event by the simple process of governing our thought forces today. We help create the events which will come into our lives in the future, perhaps even tomorrow. Educated desire is the most potent means of bringing into action the law of attraction. Man is so constituted that he must first create the tools or implements by which he gains the power to think. The mind cannot comprehend an entirely new idea until a corresponding vibratory brain cell has been prepared to receive it. This explains why it is so difficult for us to receive or appreciate an entirely new idea. We have no brain cell capable of receiving it. We are therefore incredulous. We do not believe it. If, therefore, you've not been familiar with the omnipotence of the law of attraction and the scientific method by which it can be put into operation, or if you've not been familiar with the unlimited possibilities which it opens to those who are enabled to take advantage of the resources it offers, begin now and create the necessary brain cells which will enable you to comprehend the unlimited powers which may be yours by cooperating with natural law. This is done by concentration or attention. The intention governs the attention. Power comes through repose. It is by concentration that deep thoughts, wise speech, and all forces of high potentiality are accomplished. It is in the silence that you get into touch with the omnipotent power of the subconscious mind from which all power is evolved. He who desires wisdom, power, or permanent success of any kind will find it only within. It is an unfoldment. The unthinking may conclude that the silence is very simple and easily attained, but it should be remembered that only in absolute silence may one come into contact with divinity itself. We may learn of the unchangeable law and open for himself the channels by which persistent practice and concentration lead to perfection. This week, go to the same room, take the same chair, the same position as previously. Be sure to relax. Let go, both mentally and physically. Always do this. Never try to do any mental work under pressure. See that there are no tense muscles or nerves, that you are entirely comfortable. Now realize your unity with omnipotence. Get into touch with this power. Come into a deep and vital understanding, appreciation, and realization of the fact that your ability to think is your ability to act upon the universal mind and bring it into manifestation. Realize that it will meet any and every requirement, that you have exactly the same potential ability which any individual ever did have or ever will have, because each is but an expression or manifestation of the one. All are parts of the whole. There is no difference in kind or quality. The only difference being
science is responsible for the marvelous age of invention in which we're now living. But spiritual science is now setting out on a career whose possibilities that no one can foretell. Spiritual science has previously been the football of the uneducated, the superstitious, the mystical. But men are now interested in definite methods and demonstrated facts only. We have come to know that thinking is a spiritual process, that vision and imagination preceded action and event, that the day of the dreamer has come. The following lines by Mr. Herbert Kaufman are interesting in this connection. Quote, "They are the architects of greatness. Their vision lies within their souls. They peer beyond the veils and mists of doubt and pierce the walls of unborn time. The belted wheel, the trail of steel, the churning screw are shuttles in the loom on which they weave their magic tapestries. Makers of empires, they have fought for bigger things than crowns and higher seats than thrones. Your homes are set upon the land a dreamer found. The pictures on its walls are visions from a dreamer's soul. They are the choice few, the blazers of the way. Walls crumble and empires fall. The tidal wave sweeps from the sea and tears a fortress from its rocks. The rotting nations drop off from time's bow, and only things the dreamers make live on." Part 13, which follows, tells why the dreams of the dreamer come true. It explains the law of causation by which dreamers, inventors, authors, financiers, and others bring about the realization of their desires.
It explains the law by which the thing pictured upon our mind eventually becomes our own. And now part 13. It has been the tendency, and as might be proved, a necessity for science to seek the explanation of everyday facts by a generalization of those others which are less frequent and form the exception. Thus does the eruption of the volcano manifest the heat which is continually at work in the interior of the earth, and to which the latter owes much of her configuration. Thus does the lightning reveal a subtle power, constantly busy to produce changes in the inorganic world. And as dead languages now seldom heard were once ruling among the nations, so does a giant tooth in Siberia or a fossil in the depth of the earth not only bear record of the evolution of past ages, but thereby explains to us the origin of the hills and valleys which we inhabit today. In this way, a generalization of facts which are rare, strange, or form the exception has been the magnetic needle guiding to all the discoveries of inductive science. This method is founded upon reason and experience, and thereby destroyed superstition, precedent, and conventionality. It is almost 300 years since Lord Bacon recommended this method of study, to which the civilized nations owe the greater part of their prosperity and the more valuable part of their knowledge, purging the mind from narrow prejudices, denominated theories, more effectually than by the keenest irony, calling the attention of men from heaven to earth more successfully by surprising experiments than by the most forcible demonstration of their ignorance, educating the inventive faculties more powerfully by the near prospect of useful discoveries thrown open to all than by talk of bringing to light the innate laws of our mind. The method of Bacon has seized the spiritual and aim of the great philosophers of Greece and carried them into effect by the new means of observation which another age offered, thus gradually revealing a wondrous field of knowledge in the infinite space of astronomy, in the microscopic egg of embryology, and the dim age of geology disclosing an order of the pulse which the logic of Aristotle could never have unveiled, and analyzing into formerly unknown elements the material combinations which no dialectic of the scholastics could ever force apart. It has lengthened life, it has mitigated pain, it has extinguished diseases, it has increased the fertility of the soil, it has given new securities to the mariner, it has spanned great rivers with bridges of form unknown to our fathers. It has guided the thunderbolt from heaven to earth. It has lighted up night with the splendor of day. It has extended the range of human vision. It has multiplied the power of the human muscles. It has accelerated motion. It has annihilated distance. It has facilitated intercourse, correspondence, all friendly offices, all dispatch of business. It has enabled men to descend into the depths of the sea, to soar into the air, to penetrate securely into the noxious recesses of the earth. This, then, is the true nature and scope of induction. But the greater the success which men have achieved in the inductive science, the more does the whole tenor of their teachings and example impress us with the necessity of observing carefully, patiently, accurately, and with all the instruments and resources at our command, the individual facts before venturing upon a statement of general laws. To ascertain the bearing of the spark drawn from the electric machine under every variety of circumstance that we may thus be emboldened with Franklin to address, in the form of a kite, the question to the cloud about the nature of lightning, to assure ourselves of the manner in which bodies fall with the exactness of a Galileo, that with Newton we may dare to ask the moon about the force that fastens it to the earth. In short, by the value we set upon truth, by our hope in a steady and universal progress, not to permit a tyrannical prejudice to neglect or mutilate unwelcome facts, but to rear the superstructure of science upon the broad and unchangeable basis of full attention paid to the most isolated as well as the most frequent phenomena. An ever-increasing material may be collected by observation, but the accumulated facts are of very different value for the explanation of nature, and as we esteem most highly those useful qualities of men which are of the rarest occurrence, so does natural philosophy sift the facts and attach a preeminent importance to that striking class which cannot be accounted for by the usual and daily observation of life. If, then, we find that certain persons seem to possess unusual power, what are we to conclude? Well, first, we may say it's not so, which is simply an acknowledgement of our lack of information, because every honest investigator admits that there are many strange and previously unaccountable phenomena constantly taking place. Those, however, who become acquainted with the creative power of thought, will no longer consider them unaccountable. Second, we may say that they are the result of supernatural interference, but a scientific understanding of natural laws will convince us that there is nothing supernatural. Every phenomenon is the result of an accurate, definite cause, and the cause is an immutable law or principle which operates with invariable precision, whether the law is put into operation consciously or unconsciously. Third, we may say that we're on forbidden ground, that there are some things which we just should not know. Well, this objection was used against every advance in human knowledge. Every individual who ever advanced a new idea, whether a Columbus, a Darwin, a Galileo, a Fulton, or an Emerson, was subjected to ridicule or persecution, so that this objection should receive no serious consideration. But on the contrary, we should carefully consider every fact which is brought to our attention. By doing this, we will more readily ascertain the law upon which it is based. It will be found that the creative power of thought will explain every possible condition or experience, whether physical, mental, or spiritual. Thought will bring about conditions in correspondence with the predominant mental attitude. Therefore, if we fear disaster, as fear is a powerful form of thought, disaster will be the certain result of our thinking. It is this form of thought which frequently sweeps away the result of many years of toil and effort. If we think of some form of material wealth, we may secure it. By concentrated thought, the required conditions will be brought about, and the proper effort put forth, which will result in bringing about the circumstances necessary to realize our desires. But we often find that when we secure the things we thought we wanted, they don't have the effect we expected. That is, the satisfaction is only temporary, or possibly is the reverse of exactly what we expected. What then is the proper method of procedure? What are we to think in order to secure what we really desire? What you and I desire, what we all desire, what everyone is seeking, is happiness and harmony. If we can truly be happy, we shall have everything the world can give. If we're happy ourselves, we can make others happy. But we cannot be happy unless we have health, strength, congenial friends, pleasant environment, sufficient supply, not only to take care of our necessities, but to provide for those comforts and luxuries to which we are entitled. The old orthodox way of thinking was to be a worm, to be satisfied with our portion, whatever it is. But the modern idea is to know that we are entitled to the best of everything, that the Father and I are one, and that the Father is the universal mind, the Creator, the original substance from which all things proceed. Now, admitting that His is all true in theory, and it has been taught for 2,000 years, and is the essence of every system of philosophy or religion, how are we to make it practical in our lives? How are we to get the actual tangible results here and now? In the first place, we must put our knowledge into practice. Nothing can be accomplished in any other way. The athlete may read books and lessons on physical training all of his life, but unless he begins to give out strength by actual work, he will never receive any strength. He will eventually get exactly what he gives, but he will have to give it first. It's exactly the same with us. We will get exactly what we give, but we shall have to give it first. It will then return to us manyfold, and the giving is simply a mental process, because thoughts are causes and conditions are effects. Therefore, in giving thoughts of courage, inspiration, health, or help of any kind, we're setting causes in motion which will bring about their effect. Thought is a spiritual activity and is therefore creative. But make no mistake, thought will create nothing unless it is consciously, systematically, and constructively directed. And herein is the difference between idle thinking, which is simply a dissipation of effort, and constructive thinking, which means practically unlimited achievement. We found that everything we get comes to us by the law of attraction. A happy thought cannot exist in unhappy consciousness. Therefore, the consciousness must change, and as the consciousness changes, all conditions necessary to meet the changed consciousness must gradually change in order to meet the requirements of the new situation. In creating a mental image or an ideal, we are projecting thought into the universal substance from which all things are created. This universal substance is omnipresent, omnipotent, and omniscient. Are we to inform the omniscient as to the proper channel to be used to materialize our demand? Can the finite advise the infinite? This is the cause of failure, of every failure. We recognize the omnipresence of the universal substance, but we fail to appreciate the fact that this substance is not only omnipresent, but it is omnipotent, and omniscient, and will consequently set causes in motion concerning which we may be entirely ignorant. We can best conserve our interest by recognizing the infinite power and infinite wisdom of the universal mind, and in this way become a channel whereby the infinite can bring about the realization of our desire. This means that recognition brings about realization. Therefore, for your exercise this week, make use of the principle, recognize the fact that you're a part of the whole, and that a part must be the same in kind and quality as the whole. The only difference there can possibly be is in degree. When this tremendous fact begins to permeate your consciousness, when you really come into a realization of the fact that you, not your body, but the ego, the I, the spirit which thinks, is an integral part of the great whole, that it is the same in substance, in quality, and kind, that the Creator could create nothing different from Himself, you'll also be able to say, "The Father and I are one." And you will come into an understanding of the beauty, the grandeur, the transcendental opportunities which have been placed at your disposal. Increase in me that wisdom which discovers my truest interest. Strengthen my resolution to perform that which wisdom dictates. Benjamin Franklin. You have found from your study thus far that thought is a spiritual activity and is therefore endowed with creative power. This does not mean that some thought is creative, but that all thought is creative. This same principle can be brought into operation in a negative way through the process of denial. The conscious and subconscious are but two phases of action in connection with one mind. The relation of the subconscious to the conscious is quite analogous to that existing between a weather vane and the atmosphere. Just as the least pressure of the atmosphere causes an action on the part of the weather vane, so does the least thought entertained by the conscious mind produce within your subconscious mind action in exact proportion to the depth of feeling characterizing the thought and the intensity with which the thought is indulged. It follows then that if you deny unsatisfactory conditions, you are withdrawing the creative power of your thought from those conditions. You're cutting them away at the root. You are sapping their vitality. Remember that the law of growth necessarily governs every manifestation in the objective, so that a denial of unsatisfactory conditions will not bring about instant change. A plant will remain visible for some time after its roots have been cut, but it will gradually fade away and eventually disappear. So the withdrawal of your thought from the contemplation of unsatisfactory conditions will gradually but surely terminate these conditions. You'll see that this is an exactly opposite course from the one which we would naturally be inclined to adopt. It will therefore have an exactly opposite effect to the one usually secured. Most persons concentrate intently upon unsatisfactory conditions, thereby giving the condition that measure of energy and vitality which is necessary in order to supply a vigorous growth. And now part 14. The universal energy in which all motion, light, heat, and color have their origin does not partake of the limitation of the many effects of which it is the cause, but it is supreme over them all. This universal substance is the source of all power, all wisdom, and all intelligence. To recognize this intelligence is to acquaint yourself with the knowing quality of mind and through it to move upon the universal substance and bring it into harmonious relations in your affairs. This is something that the most learned physical science teacher has not attempted, a field of discovery upon which he has not yet launched. In fact, but few of the materialistic schools have ever caught the first ray of this light. It doesn't seem to have dawned upon them that wisdom is just as much present everywhere as our force and substance. Now some will say, if these principles are true, why are we not demonstrating them? As the fundamental principle is obviously correct, why do we not get proper results? Well, we do. We get results in exact accordance with our understanding of the law and our ability to make the proper application. We secured no results from the laws governing electricity until someone formulated that law and showed us how to apply it. This puts us in an entirely new relation to our environment, opening up possibilities previously undreamed of, and this by an orderly sequence of law which is naturally involved in our new mental attitude. Mind is creative, and the principle upon which this law is based is sound and legitimate, and is inherent in the nature of things. But this creative power does not originate in the individual, but in the universal, which is the source and fountain of all energy and substance. The individual is simply the channel for the distribution of this energy. The individual is the means by which the universal produces the various combinations which result in the formation of phenomena. We know that scientists have resolved matter into an immense number of molecules. These molecules have been resolved into atoms and the atoms into electrons. The discovery of electrons in high-vacuum glass tubes containing fused terminals of hard metal indicates conclusively that these electrons fill all space, that they exist everywhere, and that they are omnipresent. They fill all material bodies and occupy the whole of what we call empty space. This, then, is the universal substance from which all things proceed. Electrons would forever remain electrons unless directed where to go, to be assembled into atoms and molecules, and this director is mind. A number of electrons revolving around a center of force constitutes an atom. Atoms unite in absolutely regular mathematical ratios and form molecules, and these unite with each other to form a multitude of compounds which unite to build the universe. The lightest known atom is hydrogen, and this is 1,700 times heavier than an electron. An atom of mercury is 300,000 times heavier than an electron. Electrons are pure negative electricity, and as they have the same potential velocity as all other cosmic energy, such as heat, light, electricity, and thought, which is 189,380 miles per second, neither time nor space require consideration. The manner in which the velocity of light was ascertained is interesting. The velocity of light was obtained by the Danish astronomer Romer in 1676 by observing the eclipses of Jupiter's moons. When the Earth was nearest to Jupiter, the eclipse appeared about 8.5 minutes too soon for the calculations, and when the Earth was most remote from Jupiter, they were about 8.5 minutes too late. Romer concluded the reason to be that it required 17 minutes for light from the planet to traverse the diameter of the Earth's orbit, which measured the difference of the distance of the Earth from Jupiter. This calculation has since been verified and proves that light travels at about 186,000 feet a second. Electrons manifest in the body as cells and possess mind and intelligence sufficient for them to perform their functions in the human physical anatomy. Every part of the body is composed of cells, some of which operate independently, others in communities. Some are busy building tissue, while others are engaged in forming the various secretions that are necessary for the body. Some act as carriers of material. Others are the surgeons, whose work it is to repair damage. Others are scavengers, carrying off waste. Others are constantly ready to repel invaders or other undesirable intruders of the germ family. Now, all these cells are moving for a common purpose, and each one is not only a living organism, but has sufficient intelligence to enable it to perform its necessary duties. It is also endowed with sufficient intelligence to conserve the energies and perpetuate its own life. It must, therefore, secure sufficient nourishment, and it has been found that it exercises a choice in the selection of such nourishment. Each cell is born, reproduces itself, dies, and is absorbed. The maintenance of health and life itself depends upon the constant regeneration of these cells. It is therefore apparent that there is mind in every atom of the body. This mind is negative mind, and the power of the individual to think makes him positive, so that he can control this negative mind. This is the scientific explanation for metaphysical healing, and will enable anyone to understand the principle upon which this remarkable phenomenon rests. This negative mind, which is contained in every cell of the body, has been called the subconscious mind because it acts without our conscious knowledge. We have found that the subconscious mind is responsive to the will of the conscious mind. All things have their origin in mind, and appearances are the result of thought, so that we see that things in themselves have no origin, permanency, or reality. In mental, as in natural science, experiments are being made, and each discovery lifts man one step higher toward his possible goal. We find that every man is the reflection of the thought he has entertained during his lifetime. This is stamped on his face, his form, his character, his environment. Back of every effect there is cause, and if we follow the trail to its starting point, we shall find the creative principle out of which it grew. Proofs of this are now so complete that this truth is generally accepted. The objective world is controlled by an unseen and heretofore unexplainable power. We have heretofore personalized this power and called it God. We have now, however, learned to look upon it as the permeating essence or principle of all that exists, the infinite or the universal mind. The universal mind, being infinite and omnipotent, has unlimited resources at its command, and when we remember that it is also omnipresent, we cannot escape the conclusion that we must be an expression or manifestation of that mind. A recognition and understanding of the resources of the subconscious mind will indicate that the only difference between the subconscious and the universal is one of degree. They differ only as a drop of water differs from the ocean. They are in the same kind and quality. The difference is one of degree only. Do you, can you, appreciate the value of this all-important fact? Do you realize that a recognition of this tremendous fact places you in touch with omnipotence? The subconscious mind, being the connecting link between the universal mind and the conscious mind, is it not evident that the conscious mind can consciously suggest thoughts which the subconscious mind will put into action? And as the subconscious is one with the universal, is it not evident then that no limit can be placed upon its activities? A scientific understanding of this principle would explain the wonderful results which are secured through the power of prayer. The results which are secured in this way are not brought about by any special dispensations of providence, but on the contrary, they are the result of the operation of a perfectly natural law. There is therefore nothing either religious or mysterious about it. Yet there are many who are not ready to enter into the discipline necessary to think correctly, even though it is evident that wrong thinking has brought failure. Thought is the only reality. Conditions are but the outward manifestations. As the thought changes, all outward or material conditions must change in order to be in harmony with their creator, which is thought. But the thought must be clear-cut, steady, fixed, definite, unchangeable. You cannot take one step forward and two steps backward. Neither can you spend 20 or 30 years of your life building up negative conditions as the result of negative thoughts, and then expect to see them all melt away as the result of 15 or 20 minutes of right thinking. If you enter into the discipline necessary to bring about a radical change in your life, you must do so deliberately after giving the matter careful thought and full consideration, and then you must allow nothing to interfere with your decision. This discipline, this change of thought, this mental attitude will not only bring you the material things which are necessary for your highest and best welfare, but will bring health and harmonious conditions generally. If you wish harmonious conditions in your life, you must develop an harmonious mental attitude. Your world without will be a reflection of your world within. Now, for your exercise this week, concentrate on harmony. And when I say concentrate, I mean all that that word implies. Concentrate so deeply, so earnestly, that you will be conscious of nothing but harmony. Remember, we learn by doing. Reading these lessons will get you nowhere. It is in the practical application that the value consists. Remember these words by George Matthew Adams. Learn to keep the door shut. Keep out of your mind and out of your world every element that seeks admittance with no definite helpful end in view.